You are tuned into Business Sense on Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media.
Now, there are leaders who command respect because of their titles. And then there are those who carry a presence, earned not from the position they hold, but from the lives they've touched, the systems they've strengthened, and the standards they've raised wherever they go. Tonight's shapeshifter is fortunately the latter. Advocate Boyzi Mkize is more than a legal professional. He's a builder of institutions, a custodian of public trust, and a steward of ethical leadership in a country that needs it desperately. From the halls of justice to the highest echelons of governance, he's worn many robes and shed many, always with one constant, his conscience. Whether he was enforcing the rule of law, regulating complex sectors, or chairing national boards, he's done so with a calm courage and uncompromising integrity that sets him apart in a generation grasping for shortcuts. But that's not what makes him extraordinary. What makes him extraordinary is that despite the stature, the spotlight, and the many successes, he has remained grounded, gracious, and grateful. Tonight, we look beyond the resume. We talk about life's pivots, the lessons learned from failure, the silent sacrifices, and yes, the financial truth that seasoned his path. We explore what it means to evolve without losing yourself, to lead without arrogance, and to grow without forgetting. In a world addicted to performance, Advocate Mkize invites us into a different kind of story, one marked not just by progress, but by principle. And it is my absolute pleasure to introduce you tonight to the Advocate himself. Hello, Advocate.
Wow, Bumi. I wasn't too sure if you were talking about me.
Who did it sound like I was speaking about? Do you know this man?
that's such an amazingly humbling introduction. It sounds too big for me. But thank you so much for your grace.
How do you do?
And good evening to your listeners. I'm doing fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing well as well. Now, you've held some of the most trusted roles in our countries, from governance to law. But before all the accolades, advocates, and responsibilities, who was Boyzi Mkize as a young man? What shaped you? I'm curious about the house you were raised in. I don't know, something about you gives me ukuliso mkulu. Am I wrong?
Yeah. Well, I grew up in the rural hills of KwaSomkhele in Mdubatuba, a town that is hardly on the map and is hardly known for anything, except for the United Nations site, which is in St. Lucia, the St. Lucia wetlands, which is about 28 kilometers from Mdubatuba town. So that's where I grew up. This is in the north of KZN, about 260 Ks from Devon. That's where I grew up, and I was raised in the rural Somkhele village, in a four-roomed house with my siblings. In fact, it was a mud house, might I add. My parents then tried to put some plaster on top of the mud, and it looked a bit decent with that. No running water, no electricity.
Sure.
We used pit latrine, so when nature called at night, you had to use a torch to get out and all of that.
Yeah.
So that's the rural setting in which I grew up. We drew water from the well, which was about 4 or 5 K away from home. Wheelbarrow, we used firewood to prepare our meals. It was a hard upbringing. That's what fortified us.
Yeah.
That's what made us stronger. and that's what made us to be focused. And I do not regret an inch that that was my rural setting and background that brought about this man that's talking to you today.
Wow. And in that four-roomed house, in that mud house, what is the dream? What is the dream that then becomes law? Because I can imagine in that small place, in the rurals, there's not much that you see. So what was the dream? What was the influence? How did we get here?
Strangely enough, law was never even a contemplation.
Okay.
On my side, because when we grew up, of course, we grew up in the Adventist Christian setting, and law was viewed with suspicion.
Yes.
And it was viewed as something for non-believers.
Because you lie so much. And,
yeah, exactly. And the parents were not keen on any one of us pursuing the law degree.
Yeah.
So the only dream I had was to actually have a life that is different from the life under which I grew up, both for myself and for my parents, and for my family.
Yeah.
So the dream was to get out of the rut, get out of this rather unfortunate circumstances. So and of course, I mean, tertiary education was somewhat of a pipe dream, considering that my mother was just pulling hard with six children that she needed to look after. My dad was there working in Johannesburg, a migrant laborer. We would see him maybe twice a year if we're lucky, earning very little. And he did his bit. But in his sense, thinking of university was even something that was beyond the scope. But thank God for a mother who was so strong mentally and did everything to actually make sure we got some decent education. And I remember that for my registration at university, by the way, I'd gone to register to become a teacher.
To do teaching. Okay.
Yes. So that was the most neutral profession, and that was prevalent.
Yes.
What happened is that my mother went to the nearby white man's shop where we used to buy our groceries and loaned money for registration from him, and he was going to then service this debt, you know, over time. And that's how I managed to get registration.
Wow.
Fast forward, I get to university, and there I am waiting to register in the Faculty of Education. And I bump across this friend who is Adventist.
Okay.
And who came from Durban. That I knew from Pathfinder days, etc. I asked him, so what are you going to be doing? He says, oh, well, I'm registering for law.
Okay.
I said, you got to be kidding me.
We don't do that. Yes. We don't do those things.
Says, Yeah, no, I'm doing law without a doubt.
Yeah.
He says, no, come, you can change, you know.
Mm.
So I went and I changed. And they said, yes, you can change right there at the registration hall. And I tell you, it is a decision I have never regretted. And I didn't tell my parents, confession time.
Okay.
I didn't tell my parents until I got my first semester result.
There is no way.
And I had passed everything and I had passed well. And I said to them, by the way, I didn't pursue teaching.
Okay.
I'm doing law. Look at the results. So it was too late. And that friend happens to be Advocate Dr. Madonsela, Senior Counsel now.
I'm sure you've seen.
So we were together first year, right up to the end, and we were together all the time. So, that was the journey of choosing law as a career.
Yours is so interesting because I know people who studied degrees, and by people I really mean me, studied for certain degrees, and, you know, they were not the thing. And even studying the thing is just like, oh, Gosiam, if I can just finish so I can pursue the thing that is me. And now I'm thinking about you going to register anyone thinking, I'm going to be a teacher. Of course, you prime yourself for that, whether it's something you wanted or not, but you ready yourself for the fact that this is the life I'm going to live. And then you register for something completely different. Do you, is there anything that you account to or that you credit to you actually falling in love with this thing that was never an option for you to begin with?
I tell you, as soon as I started lectures, I fell so much in love with this profession. And it's a decision I have never regretted. And so I just think that it was God ordained and God designed, because I find myself, given the circumstances under which I grew up, becoming a social justice advocate. And that simply means that I don't look at how much clients are going to pay me. Even those that are struggling and may not be able to afford, because I've got this passion about social justice, I'm able to assist them without even consideration for money. And I do a lot of benevolent work in the law space to assist many people that would otherwise be abused by the system.
Yeah. I'm curious about that, your first days out of law school, you're starting out as, and you know, when we all get into corporates or go into the work world, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, we think we are going to change systems. What did that experience look like for you?
Well, it was quite interesting. So my major first priority was to actually get work that would pay me a salary,
of course,
and enable me to stabilize my circumstances and then start supporting back home, you know. So that was priority. And so as a result, I landed my first job at the University of KwaZulu-Natal Community Law Center, which was an NGO run by an American director, and it received funding from all over the world. And essentially, we were dealing with human rights violations and justice issues. And so that sort of grounded me into the social justice and human rights arena. So from there, the issue was to fight for people's rights and violations that people were subjected to, and it started early on. And so we took cases for people that were evicted from the farms by the oppressive system of the time. It was heydays of apartheid. We took cases of people that were whose cattle had been impounded because they strayed onto some white farm, etc., and all of those things. We took a number of cases where people were denied access to things as basic as disability grants, you know, but which meant a lot to those individuals. So we took a number of cases that basically had to do with restoring the dignity of people. And so those were the formative years. And it moved on to when I became the coordinator of the Constitutional Assembly in the KZN province, coordinating the writing of the now current Constitution of the Republic of South Africa.
Yes.
So I coordinated that process on behalf of the Constitutional Assembly, serving under the current president, who was the chairman, together with Rolf Meyer. And so that's what we did. Again, it was in the human rights space, the Bill of Rights, the constitutional rights, etc., which was the focus. And since then, I mean, from there, it was just again about forging links with frameworks that would advance the cause of human dignity.
Yeah.
And I became the deputy director at the Department of Public Service and Administration. And there, we actually changed the course of things in the entire government, because we set up, we developed the policy on the first policy on affirmative action in the country. So I was part of the team that crafted that. I was also part of the team that crafted what has come to be known in the public service as Matupili principles, transforming service delivery. And that landed me in the position of becoming chief of staff in the minister's office because of the work that we're doing together with the minister in changing the policy framework and landscape in the public service. So that led to the regulations, etc., and treating people with dignity in terms of, you know, employment practices in the public service.
And yet, Advocate says it can't be me who you just spoke about in that introduction. Excuse me, sir. What do you mean? With all this amazing work. And at this point, you know, listening to all that you've done, I want us to talk about integrity, because I think it's integral for somebody in your position doing the work that you've been doing and continue to do. The truth is, integrity can be costly. And I wonder, have there been moments in your career where doing the right thing meant walking away from power, privilege, and even peace? Take us into that tension, if there was ever such a moment, and I believe there must have been.
Plenty.
Yeah.
Plenty. So... Just in terms of the roles that one also occupied, at some point I was the CEO and registrar of the Health Professions Council of South Africa, which is the regulatory body for all the health professions in the country, excluding the nurses, because they had their own council, so medical practitioners and everyone. But what of what parts of the agenda that we were that I was charged with leading there is to develop a set of ethical rules for professions and professionals in the medical space and healthcare space. And of course, that wasn't an easy thing, because part of it was you were interfering with the commercial interests of the big conglomerates. The big private hospitals, the big practices in the various sectors or industries within medical healthcare, the optometry groups, the radiology groups, the pathological laboratories, etc. So that wasn't easy, because then you were on the spotlight.
Yes.
As this person who is actually trying to threaten and take away people's livelihoods.
Public enemy number one.
Which wasn't really livelihoods, but which was actually premised on excessive profiteering and not looking into the interest of the patient who would suffer in the process, you know. So that earned me... quite a number of enemies. But of course, at some point, one of the major issues I had to deal with were the human rights violations and ethical violations that were perpetrated during the apartheid regime, where, for example, the likes of Dr. Foto Basson had to be brought to book because of what was alleged they had done, making people to disappear using medical skills that they had. And so we found that that was unethical. So we had to pursue those type of things.
Yeah.
But I think notable for me was one area where I was a CEO post that in one entity. Obviously, you report to the board and then by extension, you also report to Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a financial development institution in one of the provinces I will not mention.
Okay.
In essence, one was exposed to a lot of volatility in the sense that there are certain demands that are placed on you to do certain things that you know are not proper or regular or ethical. And when I resisted, I was then viewed as an obstruction. What then happened is that I then got targeted.
Sure.
Things started happening and issues of just spurious allegations being thrown all around, etc. And then they dissolved the board that had appointed me, which was a clear indication that, the ground was shifting. I then eventually said to the new chairperson of the board, look, I know that these positions, each board wants their own CEO.
Yeah.
So if you feel that you are not able to work with me because of my principles, I'd rather shift. So I fell on my sword and we parted.
Sure.
And we had a mutual settlement. And I mean, I didn't know where I was going to go.
Yes.
Immediately after that, you know. But I took the leap of faith simply because I couldn't bear having to do things that were being suggested to me and that I had to oversee, and I had to put my foot down and say, well, this is not going to happen under my watch.
Yeah.
And that's really how it happened. So it cost me a job eventually.
You know, as you're speaking, I'm thinking about how easy it is to judge people who do the wrong thing. Like, it's easy to just sit and be like, how could they? But the truth is, it's equally easy to find yourself in a position where your integrity has been chipped away, where the resistance you once had is no longer there. And I'm wondering, what does it take to actually stand on what you believe is right, to hold on to that integrity and those values when it threatens your very livelihood, as was the case with you? What does it take?
Look, it takes being grounded in God, trusting God.
Yeah.
Trusting God with your life.
Yeah.
Trusting God with your life and praying.
Mm.
And I think what had happened to me up to that point, I hadn't actively applied for positions that I held, which were high positions.
Yeah.
I was headhunted.
Yes.
I was headhunted for about four prior positions to that. All right? So when I counseled with God and I said, this is the situation, God, what is your direction?
Yeah.
And God's direction to me was, but have I not looked after you?
All this time.
And when I look back and I said, look, these jobs, I did not go applying for them.
Yeah.
I was physically headhunted.
Yeah.
Not looking for the jobs. And someone just said, hey, we need you. Can you make yourself available?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, I mean, not in a way where, you know, it's just nepotistic.
Yes.
I had to apply I was invited to apply, to go through the interview process. You know, there was competition, you know, so the jobs were not just waiting for me, but, you know, the fact that I was headhunted, and as a result of that headhunt, I landed those jobs. I felt, look, the Lord has got my back. Even though I don't know where I'm going to be stepping out to, I know He's got my back. So if I stand for the right and I depart from this point, I know the Lord is going to make a way for me. And I tell you, I mean, it was hardly 2 months. I just got a call from someone that I had worked with many moons back, and he said, hey, man, can you come and head our institution, our section as director for forensics? So I joined the company, and this was now in the private sector, and I became the director in that company. It's a, it's quite a reputable audit firm in Johannesburg. And yeah, so I headed that, that entity until I then had to branch off to working for myself.
Oh, so you still didn't have to actively look for work. Lucky fish.
No, no, I don't. I mean, like, you know where you sit and you say, oh, my goodness, I'm looking at the papers every Sunday. What positions are there, and completing those forms, you know. No, the Lord has really been gracious. And He has really directed my steps and my path. And it is all grace. And that's all I attribute it to. You know?
Oh, man, you know what I've come to observe? So many people wear masks in order to survive in corporate or in public life. And I'd love to hear from you. How do you manage to keep evolving without ever losing your identity?
Yeah, look, I mean, so one of the things that have earned me a lot of enemies and earned me a lot of friends at the same time is just being forthright. So for me, it's either it is black or white. You know, there's no middle course. So and fortunately, what the Lord has given me is the courage of my conviction to be able to actually also articulate it. And so I proverbially speak truth to power. So it could be the chairman of a board, it could be anyone. I'm able to say to them, but this is not how I see it. This is not how it should be done. I mean, just today, I had a meeting with the shareholders and one of my clients. And these are big guys that, you know, hold huge, huge multi-millions in terms of the business operations. And I had to tell them that you can't do what you're wanting to do because X, Y, Z. And they say, no, but this is how. I said, well, you do it at your own peril. My advice is on record. So I think... for me, what I've learned is that straight talk and being forthright and standing for the principle does not, you know, cause harm more than just trying to be something that you're not, you know? And so I encourage people to be forthright. It's just the best thing, know? I mean, it's like when I went to all sorts of the interviews, I will tell people that I don't do work on Sabbath. You know, just upfront, you know? And I knew that that might actually jeopardize my opportunities. You know, for getting the jobs. And if I can tell you the experiences I've had in all the areas where I stood my ground at interview level and told them that I'm not going to compromise. And as I walked out of that interview, I thought, well, I've lost this job. You know, 3 days later, I get a call.
We're happy to inform you.
we are very happy to offer you the job.
Yeah.
And we understand your Sabbath principle. You know, that for me was the biggest form of witness. I mean, in one job, we had to attend conferences in the U.S. with my chairman of the board. And the congresses would start on a Thursday and go and end on Sabbath, you know. So I told my boss, well, you know my situation, so I will attend Thursday, Friday. All right, Saturday, I'll be in church. He says, oh, no, I know that. I will do the report for Sabbath. And you can do the rest, you know, and do your church on Sabbath. I know that you cannot be disturbed. So I used to brag a little and say, well, my boss does the work for me.
While I rest. <On Sabbath>. You shall be heads and not tails.
So, but on a serious note, my issue was, a lot of us, as Adventists in particular, we tend to compromise on some of these things, thinking, oh, well, this is going to make the opportunities to disappear. If you stand for principle, people realize this is the man we need. This is the woman we need. And I think it has worked for me wonders.
You know, what I love about you saying it's a principle instead of a law or just something that you do is that the principle then extends to every other day beyond the Sabbath, right? The work is so excellent on the other days that it's like, of course he has to rest. Have you seen the output? Of course he's deserving and worthy of the rest. I think this is where we miss it. We want to rest.
Yes.
Without putting in the work that qualifies us for the rest. And so people don't even take us or the day seriously because there's no significance or distinction. So it's like, why are you resting? Continue. So I love that you call it a principle.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have never been invited into a performance improvement session, anyone complaining about diligence, anyone complaining about the quality and the standard of work, you know? You know, so, I mean, even now when I do work for clients, etc., I mean, someone, just recently I sent them a legal opinion and they said, well, Oisey has spoken. You know? So that's the level of trust that you create just by going an extra mile, being diligent and making sure that your whatever you touch is underlined by quality. You know? And when that's what we ought to do.
Yes.
I mean, didn't the Lord say, I have anointed you to become heads and not tails?
100%.
You know? I mean, 100%. That is the essence.
You can't be a head that's not doing head work.
It doesn't work.
No. You know, from this conversation alone, even if people didn't know you, it's very clear that you've reinvented yourself several times. I mean, you now run your own practice. And I want to find out, what gave you the courage to pivot when others would have clung to comfort or titles? Because we do it a lot. There's just so much uncertainty. Let me hold on to the thing that looks like it's stable. So what gives you the courage to pivot and to follow the thing that is tugging at your heart in the moment?
Look, I love law. Yeah. I love standing on behalf of people that are vulnerable. I love standing for those that otherwise would not have a voice. I love the technical aspect of my job and how it evolves. It's never a boring. There's never a dull moment. So you get exposed to different things. So and that's me. So I can't deal with mundane stuff, you know, repetitive, you know, that type of thing. So
yeah.
I get bored easily. I looked at this, but of course the other thing which was a strong influencer for me was as I grow older, I'm getting more impatient with having to account to below par individuals. What do I mean? So you find that, you know, you are a CEO of an organization.
Yeah.
You report to a board that has got individuals that are so out of touch with reality, all right? Who are inexperienced, who have never served as senior managers,
sure.
let alone becoming executives,
sure.
you know? And so they've got no appreciation
yeah.
Of what it means to be a CEO
yeah.
and to run a company.
What's happening on
so,
the ground?
So you're there, you're trying to transform.
We've lost you there, advocate. Okay, you're back.
Hi, sorry. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, and then they put all sorts of obstacles. And sometimes it becomes issues of jealousy. No, the CEO can't earn so much. You know, that type of thing, because they've never been exposed to those type of salaries
yeah.
themselves.
Yeah.
So it becomes a whole host of issues.
Yeah.
So I got irritated and I got tired, frankly, of having to justify myself to individuals and having to, you know, a small little thing like I have to ask for leave, you know. can I go and leave
yes.
now, you know, type of thing.
It's a family
know?
Matter.
So, you know, so... So I thought, look, time has come. Let me go and be on my own and pursue business interests and in the process be helping others, you know. And that's what motivated me. It's not a journey without its challenges. But can I tell you that the Lord has been so gracious. Sometimes clients don't pay, but one of the skills. That the Lord has endowed me with, which I'm grateful for, is just the ability, and if young people could pick up on this, the ability to diversify, number one. Number two, the strength of your networks, right? Nothing, if outside of prayer, those two things, you need to have. Otherwise, you're going to struggle in a very highly competitive environment in which we are.
Yeah. Sure. Now, you've been a regulator, an advisor. You are a legal mind. But what have you learned about yourself through all these roles? And I'm more curious about what surprised you most about who you became.
Yeah, what surprised me most about who I became was just how assertive I could become and how stubborn I could become on certain principles. That surprised me about myself.
Yeah, yeah. So you thought you were going to cut corners?
I thought at some point, you know, the rural boy, you didn't even study and Model C schools. I did my matric using a candle, to study. My first year at law school, I was still using a candle because I couldn't afford fees to stay inside campus, you know. So I thought, I'm not going to be forthright and as assertive and as confident as I became. So that surprised me about myself. But there were traits as I grew up. When I look back, there were traits and some strands of being confident and assertive. And I suppose church played a very big role because I can tell you that at age 8 to 10, 8 years, 10 years, I was already choristering in church.
Yeah.
And I would, there was an old elder Nyoni, Nyoni, who has since passed away. And he would put me on the desk, on top of the desk, and I would chorister the church standing on top of the desk.
Yeah.
And so that grounded me into some confidence.
Yeah.
I became the youngest deacon to be ordained, I think, at about age 13 or 14, thereabout. So that sort of gave me some traits of confidence and being able to deal with people.
Mm.
But it surprised me the way that it came, like in later life, yeah.
We owe a lot to this church, hey? I remember one time I was presenting, I think I was in third or fourth year, I was presenting for a subject we were doing, a transportation subject we were doing in class. And right. At the end of it, one of my lecturers was like, "Did you do Toastmasters?" And I'm like, "No." Yeah. And he said to me, "I would sell anything you're buying because you are just that good." And I'm thinking, it's the Sabbath school. It's the
Sabbath school.
It's the special items. We owe a lot to this church. We're on radio tonight because of all those lessons and all those opportunities that in other churches and others in other situations are only granted to, you know, the pastors and all those big people. But everyone in this church gets the opportunity.
For sure. For sure.
And I'm looking at the time and I'm just like, hate it. Hate it. But we have to wrap up.
Sure.
Now that you're in a season where your influence carries even greater weight, what is the legacy you hope to leave?
Well, the legacy I always pray to leave behind is the spirit of selflessness, the spirit of carrying others' burdens. I've tried to inculcate this to my children, and thankfully I see them practicing it even when I'm not there, and I already praise God for it when I see how selfless they've become.
Yeah.
And what they do in running a mile on behalf of others that need their support. So that's the one. The second is influencing people for social socioeconomic change. Understanding that part of what we need to do as a people is to look deep inside us and find those things that would create not just for us but for our communities at large sustainability. Right? I always, when I talk to young people, worry about, and I ask a simple question. Do you know where the food you are eating comes from? You know, and what is it that we're doing in terms of food security and sustainability in the country? So the levels of poverty that we see, I attribute them to the poverty of the mind. And until we are able to transform Romans chapter 12, be ye therefore transformed by the renewing of your mind. Until we are able to transform the way we think, we will continuously be bogged down in cords of poverty. And that poverty is not so much commercial as it is mental. And I think once we get to that realization, we can then do a whole lot of good. And of course, part of that poverty is also spiritual poverty. And I think that our society will all the more better for understanding that there are two things that we fail to do as a community. It is to love God supremely and to love our neighbors as we love ourselves.
The only
and if
command.
We were to do that,
yeah,
we would never have the levels of unemployment, the levels of poverty that we're exposed to, and the levels of greed that we see, and unethical behavior that we see, all because we have not transformed the way we think. And so that's the legacy I hope to leave, and to make sure that, I mean, basic things like living infrastructure. In my church, I've said to young people, you know, it is important for us, as black people in particular, to leave lasting legacies.
Yes.
And that's why I have been at the forefront of establishing the church at Tesda, so that young people can understand that we need to create infrastructure, not just for us, but for our generations.
That is so profound. It's giving us something to really think about. And while we think about what you've just said, I want you right now to just for a moment think about the Boise of 20 years ago. Right?
Yeah.
What would you say to that Boise? Not as advice, though, but as reassurance.
Yeah, what I would say to that Boise of 20 years ago is your dreams and your aspirations need to translate into tangibles.
Sure.
And so you need to invest in those dreams as early as now, because had I invested the amount of passion I have for the dreams and the things that I've just shared with you 20 years back, we will be talking something different at this stage. But you see, when we get bogged down by the rat race and the fact that we have to report to someone, we lose our own identity and we lose our own lives. And the type of impact we could otherwise have had it not been for being entangled, you know, in that red race.
Yeah.
And so that's really the message I would give.
You know, in a time when public office is often used as a stepping stone to private gain, it is rare and so refreshing to sit across, well, in this case, to be on the line with a man who used power to protect and not to profit. It is so refreshing, absolutely refreshing.
Yeah.
What you've given us tonight, advocates, is not just wisdom, but a blueprint. And it's really a blueprint for how we can show up in boardrooms and courtrooms for those who are lawyers, in leadership and just in life. And get this, with our souls still intact. Because I think we get to these places and we realize, when we look back, we realize my soul got lost somewhere and we can't even put a finger to where that place is. And as I'm sitting here, my desire really is that we all have the courage to rise with integrity, to lead with the humility that you have, and to live in such a way that who we are matters more than what we achieve. When you spoke about legacy, it wasn't even about the things that you will leave. It was about who you would have become, but who other people would have become because of your influence. And so thank you so much, not just for your time, but for your testimony. This was such an incredible conversation.
Thank you so much for having me, and a great evening to you, and thanks for the most amazing show.
Thank you.
May everyone be inspired, and
love
God
it.
Bless you.
Thank you so much.
You.
Have a lovely evening.
You too. Thank you.
Do you see why I love these shapeshifters? Yo! Yo! I am really inspired to just do the thing. Do the thing that I say I want to do. Be the person I know I was created to be. Ah, man. We've got no excuse. We've got absolutely no excuse. I think at the latter part of the conversation, the advocate was talking to us about make the dream real. It's all good and well to have these aspirations, but make the dream real. And that for me was the takeaway. And with that, I am Nompumelelo Lombonani, and I hope you have just made sense
of your life, no less.
Fresh mercies tomorrow. You and I will chat again on Monday. Ciao for now.
Adventist World Radio SID Media. We are not general practitioners. We are specialists in Bible-based content.